Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the weekly show here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored that brings Christians and non-Christians together in dialogue and debate. Don't forget, straight after Unbelievable, you can hear The Profile, a high-profile Christian talks about their walk of faith and life. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. But today we're going to be hearing a conversation between Mike McCarg and Ben Watts. Really looking forward to today's discussion. A reminder, you can get in touch with the show as well. I'll be giving the ways to do that a little later on, and we'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's program. We've had some interesting debates on science and faith in recent weeks, as well as that podcast special from last week. Because of our fundraising appeal, we didn't have an on-air show, but I did put out a debate that took place between David Wood and Michael Shermer. If you want to find out more about Unbelievable, listen to past episodes, subscribe to the podcast, and much more besides, go to premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. There's links there to articles and blogs and features and videos and things as well. But you'll also find links to Unbelievable, the conference on DVD. Back in July, we had a wonderful day with speakers from all over the world and over 750 people joining us in London for the apologetics conference that really helps you to think through your faith. And if you want to get hold of that, then go to the Premier shop, premier.org.uk/shop for Unbelievable, the conference 2016. Also digital download available. Got a special offer as well if you want it bundled with the limited edition Unbelievable t-shirts we were putting on offer at the conference. Then you can find a special deal for that as well. Perhaps something for the loved one in your life or just for yourself in the run-up to Christmas. premier.org.uk/shop, and again the links available from the show website, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. It's so lovely when new listeners get in touch. A quick shout out before we begin today's show to Joel. Says, I'm a relatively new listener to the program, but Unbelievable has quickly become my favorite podcast. I appreciate the well-known and knowledgeable guests that you have on your show. Also appreciate the cordiality of the debates. I'm a listener from across the pond in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. I'd love to listen to a live debate moderated by you within Canada if you make it over this way. Thanks for all you do. Thank you for listening, Joel. Glad you found the show. And yes, who knows, maybe one day we'll get out there. Right now, though, time to do it, as we normally do, here in London, with my guests who join me from all over the world. Here's today's programme.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, we're talking about finding God in the waves, how Mike McCarg lost his faith and found it again through science. Well, Mike is known online as Science Mike. He's the host of two podcasts, Ask Science Mike and The Liturgists. His new book, Finding God in the Waves, tells his journey, having been a Southern Baptist all his life, of losing his faith and becoming a secret atheist, really, all the while pretending to be a Christian at church. A self-confessed science nerd from childhood, he came to see the world in purely atheistic scientific terms for a number of years. He also tells the story of how he returned to faith after an experience on a beach. You're going to find out about that today and where he lands today on the whole issue of science and faith and Jesus. Today he's in conversation with my atheist guest Ben Watts, Ben is a former guest on this programme. He's a science researcher in Cambridge. He was an evangelical Christian growing up until he lost his faith around university time, studying biology and evolution. We'll hear his story again today and see what he makes of Mike's story. He's been reading the book and I'm really looking forward to what I think will be a really good conversation. A very warm welcome both Mike and Ben to the programme today.
Hello, good to be here.
Thanks so much.
Mike, great to have you on the line. Ben, great to have you back in studio.
Yeah.
It's been a little while, I think a year and a half or more, since you were last in, talking to Drew Dick, I think, on that occasion.
That's right.
So I obviously only get you in with Americans on the other end of the line, but it's lovely. We'll get a recap on your story for those who may not remember it fully. Mike, lovely to have you on the show today, and someone who I've often been told I should get on the show at some point. So what an ideal opportunity now you've got this new book out. Mike, tell us a little bit about your background. Science, Mike, is how you're normally known or very often known, and that's because you run a podcast along those lines. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got into science and why you love science so much?
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing to take away is I relate to science in the way like a rabid football fan relates to football.
Okay.
Like, I don't play football. I just love football and know a lot about it. So when people hear me called Science Mike, they make crazy assumptions like I'm a working scientist or I have a science background. And I'm really just a nerd who's good at explaining things because I have a career in advertising.
Well, there you
so,
go.
So the internet dubbed me the whole Science Mike thing. And I started this work by trying to explain scientific concepts to people who grew up in evangelicalism,
mm-hmm.
who are trying to catch up with the rest of the world. And the work grew out of that.
Yeah. And of course, you co-host the Liturgist podcast with Michael Gunga. And that's been an interesting partnership, you know, the scientist and the artist. I guess you're interested in exploring those kinds of partnerships, are you?
Yeah, well, we found that typically media will explore things from a scientific lens or a faith perspective or an artistic perspective. And we wanted to blur those lines and see what happens when you get people across disciplines discussing really relevant, pertinent topics today. And that it might create better conversations when you bring in people whose basic view of the world are dissimilar.
Mm.
And we found that to be the case. It's been a much more popular show than we ever thought it would be.
Well, it has been. I listen myself. I know many others who do. If you're a podcast listener, you enjoy Unbelievable, you may well enjoy the Liturgists podcast as well. But you're here to talk about your book, Mike, which in some ways you've talked about your story over the years in different contexts and, of course, on your own podcast. This, if you like, is the de facto version, if such a thing can exist, written down in print. And just at the outset, I'd like to say what a lovely read it is. I really, really enjoyed reading this. This was a pleasure to read, not a chore in any way. And so extremely well written. You put your story across so well. Obviously, we've only a relatively short amount of time to hear it today. But do you want to sort of take us back to how you grew up, the home you grew up in, and where things kind of fell apart when it came to your faith eventually?
So I was a really nerdy kid, and I was just horribly bullied. Now, I earned that to some degree. I wore Hawaiian shirts and, you know, talked about computer science and biology for fun.
You were a geek, basically.
Total geek. And I had a loving home life and a really supportive church. So this started my life in a very odd tension where I understood the world best through science, but I found social and emotional validation through religion. That's an incredibly powerful draw.
Mm.
And because I was Southern Baptist, God was depicted to me as a personal being, a God that cared for me personally, a Jesus who knew my name. And for someone who felt unknown and unloved, oh man, that was powerful.
Mm.
So I was deeply religious growing up. I was a 7-year-old who would pray on the playground instead of, you know, swinging on the swing set. And I grew up and stayed Southern Baptist. I got married as a young Southern Baptist. I became the youngest Southern Baptist deacon at my church. Just, you know, all the little gold stars for religious participation.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until right around when I was 30 that my dad announced he was leaving my mom after 30 years of marriage, 32, I think. And that wrecked me because my dad was like my hero, but also my spiritual mentor, because he was a music minister at our church. He was a also a deacon, you know, all the things that I looked for in someone who loved God. And so I started to search the Bible for answers to what had happened in my parents' marriage. And as so many people will be familiar with in their own life, that reading the Bible closely didn't answer my questions about God. It just gave me many, many more.
Mm.
And after a few years, actually about 6 months of intense Bible study, my faith started to fall apart. And within 12 months, I was an atheist. But it's tough to be a Southern Baptist atheist, right? That's not a,
well, you
a
describe,
cultural thing.
You describe very well, and I kind of feel your pain, you know, as you write this in the book, that, that this sort of double life you led, effectively, for the sake of your family and daughters and wife, kind of wanting to continue to do the, you know, the standard thing, turning up in church, going through the motions, but inside feeling like it was all a sham. That didn't last all that long. Your wife is a smart cookie by the sound of it, and worked out that something was awry. So you kind of had to confess it to her, and that was obviously a difficult thing for you.
Oh yeah. I mean, 2 years of like pretending, and then suddenly here she comes swinging through the illusion. And I'd been afraid to tell her for a reason.
Yeah.
And at first my greatest fears were like confirmed, because she felt deeply betrayed. She felt wounded. She wasn't sure that we could remain married. And that really started the darkest days of our marriage. I know it was a tough time.
Yeah, absolutely. You also had your mother on your case as well. And, you tell all this in the book. I mean, we're covering a lot of ground quite quickly here, but you came to a kind of a point where you sort of had eventually decided, I'm not a Christian, I'm not even a theist, I'm an atheist. I think that all that really does explain the world is science and the way we work things out in that kind of way. So we're turning a lot of pages here, but you...
one thing I'd love to say about...
Yeah, go ahead. Mm.
I wasn't like a miserable atheist. I didn't have any longing to return to faith. Humanism, which is a philosophy that kind of grows from an atheistic assumption, really helped me find hope and meaning and purpose in the world. And I'd become a contented humanist.
Mm.
So the way the story turned and I ended up having an encounter with God was surprising and frankly unnerving for me at the time.
Just take us through that story, because part of your journey involves someone that I have had the chance to interview a few times, Rob Bell, on this program. And you came across him, I guess you'd read some of his books, but it was really a small conference for creative types and leaders and so on, that there was a bit of a turning point in your story. Do you want to take that in your own words?
Sure. I mean, I went to that conference to learn about how to be consistently creative, because I was an advertising person. And when you work in advertising, you are under constant pressure to churn out new ideas. And I enjoyed the conference from that perspective. But a few hours in, someone started talking about the Enlightenment. And then it turned into this like group therapy session about skepticism and atheism and why those are bad things. And this really offended my sensibilities as a non-believer. And that led me to do something I'd never done, sort of publicly denounce my faith in this room of pastors, wanting them to understand that their assumptions about skepticism and atheism were incorrect. And I started out pretty kind and polite, but ended very pointed.
Mm.
By saying, you know, how can anyone who understands how the universe works believe in God? And instead of throwing me out, which is what I frankly expected, they were very gracious and kind and didn't try to confront or correct me. Mm-hmm. Rob, in his very charming way, encouraged me to approach uncertainty maybe with a little more humility, but didn't prescribe, you know, that I should have any particular beliefs about God. And that was pleasant, I guess. Mm. And at the end of the conference, they decided to offer the Eucharist, which I found kind of offensive and minimizing. But I ended up taking it anyway because, and this is where my story gets very, very strange, admittedly, I heard what I ascribe to the voice of Jesus speak to me. And then a few hours later, I kind of went out on the beach very confused by the whole experience and was venting my frustration with the whole idea of God and explaining why I didn't think God was possible. And God, if you exist, then you're probably evil. And I made my case, I think, quite well. And then I saw this light, this incredibly bright light. And it kind of enveloped me and surrounded me, and I felt warm and I felt loved, and I felt God's love for everyone. And it's really difficult, especially in a shorter format radio discussion, to explain the emotional intensity and, frankly, the otherworldly quality of that moment.
Yeah. Can I read out a little bit from the book where you describe this particularly significant moment? This is coming in on the prayer you were sort of praying or shouting at God at this point, where you say, so let's make a deal. I'll try to do the best I can to do good in the world. I'll serve others and I'll work against suffering, but I have to keep asking these questions about your justice and mercy, and I can't forget about science. So let's just keep talking about this, you and I. I don't ever want to be away from you again. I can't do that anymore. All I know is I met Jesus tonight. And then you say, when I said the word Jesus, the waves rushed towards me. I was standing high up on the beach, 25 feet or more above the waves, but the water still rushed up and over my feet all the way up to my shins. I thought about what Rob had said, that Christ's last act of service before his crucifixion was to wash the feet of his followers. I said, is that you, God? Is this really happening? And the whole world fell away, like the veil lifted from the face of a bride on her wedding day. Time stopped. The waves seemed to stand still as if an unseen hand had pressed pause on the universe's remote. And you go on to describe this extraordinary experience you felt of the presence of God and say, all my doubts and questions were swept away in an ocean of light. I had no more pain or sorrow. As I say, well worth reading the full account, of course, but what you describe there, Mike, sounds like something completely different to what most people, atheists, are often say they're looking for when it comes to evidence for God. This was something that you couldn't objectively show people or point down a microscope or show some kind of data for. This was obviously an incredibly personal, subjective in that sense, experience. But for you, it was presumably what you needed at that time to bring you back?
It was not at all what I needed to bring me back.
Okay.
I went home and got a CAT scan.
Yeah,
because I thought I probably had brain cancer. And when I didn't have a tumor, I went to a psychiatric center and told them I was having hallucinations and that I needed a full psychological screening. And the first therapist that talked to me before they would kind of give me more testing, wanted to hear more about it. I described the experience. She said, I don't think you're mentally unwell. I think you're religious. I said, you don't understand. I'm an atheist. It bugged me. It ended up being more of a sand in my shoe than a source of comfort. And so I started to turn back toward the Bible and towards theologians to try to understand that experience. And that only inflamed my inner skeptic. It only made me doubt the experience more. So instead, I started to read a lot of cosmology and physics in search of what I understood to be a very universal claim about God, that God created the universe and keeps it going. And what I found in physics was a God that, if you could call it that, was mysterious but very impersonal. Mm. So it was then that I turned to neuroscience and the people that study mystical experiences, as well as what beliefs about God do to the human brain, that I found an empirical justification for the practice of religious faith, in my case, the Christian faith.
Mm.
And it was through that practice that I started to have something that resembled a faith again.
Yes, and you talk very interestingly about the nature of what happens in the brain when people pray or when they believe they're experiencing religious experiences. And you sort of say, sort of along the lines of, well, I'm going to do this, if only, because I'm aware that scientifically there are actually proven benefits to it, because at least at that level, my rational side can kind of accept doing this, even if I'm not always sure whether there's a God there listening at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, that's everything I would do is justified to deal with my doubt.
Yeah.
Everything is about not retching mentally when I start to pray.
Is there an atheist mic in you and a believing mic in you? Because you there's this interesting point in the book where you talk about the two hemispheres of our brain and how there have been experiments done where people can almost seem to have two different types of personality in them if they're kind of acting out of their left or their right hemisphere. Are there two bits of you in your brain kind of fighting against each other in that way, Mike?
Yes, I definitely have the ability to see the world as a person of faith and see the world as an atheist quite accurately.
Mm.
And some people would call that cognitive dissonance. And I think that's born out of a relative ignorance in how the brain functions. Our brain isn't some unified, singular consciousness or experience, but instead dozens, even hundreds of structures have competing and often conflicting priorities for our beliefs and our behaviors. And our experience is one where we're watching almost a messy parliament vote on what we do next. And you can prove this like just by trying to have a breakfast. And you decide, am I going to eat something nutritious or something, you know, that's very indulgent? Mm. And you can both want to have an indulgent breakfast and be a healthy person. And that's because different parts of your brain are trying to create different behaviors. And this energy I had for so many years was my religious past and the neurological network associated with my belief in God coming into conflict with the kind of rational capacity we see associated with the brain's prefrontal cortex. And what I've learned to do is get them to both sit in the room together quietly, as opposed to trying to declare one the victor.
Well, look, we're going to return to the story in a moment's time. We must bring Ben in at this point. Before we do that, let me just remind you, if you're listening and you'd like to comment on anything you hear on today's show, you're more than welcome to email in your thoughts, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can get in touch via social media as well. Just drop me a line on Twitter or Facebook, @unbelievablejb, the Twitter account. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the show on Facebook. All the links and more, my guests' links, and of course today's show from the website as well. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're looking at Finding God in the Waves today, the new book by Mike McHarg. How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science. You've heard a very brief version of Mike's story there. And in conversation with Mike today is Ben Watts. Ben is a former guest on the show. He's a science researcher in Cambridge. He has his own story of having been a Christian growing up and losing his faith, in large part, he would say, because of his studies in science. Ben, thanks for coming back on the program today.
Thanks, good to be here. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to this conversation with Mike because when I started reading Mike's book, I thought, who could I bring on that maybe has something in common with Mike? And I thought, Ben, your story has similarities, at least up to a point, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we get to your story, I mean, what was the experience like reading Mike's book? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic. Yeah,
okay.
Really enjoyed the whole experience. I thought the book was really well written, as you've already said. I think it left me with some questions and some clarifications on sort of Mike's position on certain things. But overall, I think he's a great communicator in science and a great educator in science.
And we need more of those, don't we?
Oh, we do, yes. Always, yeah.
I mean, you've enjoyed science, I think, from quite a young age yourself. Mm. Just remind us, though, quickly, you grew up in a kind of evangelical charismatic church.
Yeah.
You were baptised. You would have happily described yourself as a Christian for a number of years.
Yeah.
What sort of started to erode that Christian faith for you eventually?
I think it was, in a large part, going to university. I started to do studying in science and started to have questions about certain things in science and in the Bible, also very similar to what Mike went through in his book. And evolution was a big issue in studying. I went away to university a theistic evolutionist and would have thought that God helped guide evolution, and there were certain problems with evolution that only God could help fix.
Mm.
Studying at a university at a good depth made me realise that I could believe in evolution without needing to believe in God.
You felt it was a sort of an unnecessary,
I think so, yeah,
element.
Absolutely, yeah.
Almost. Did you have any other reasons to believe in God, though? I mean, did you have experiences that you were drawing on? I think
before going away to university, I would have considered myself an apologist or, you know, an amateur apologist. Mm. And so I knew off by heart lots of the arguments that would be given for God, lots of philosophy that would be given to support God. And I think they sort of propped me up in my faith and made me secure in Christianity.
For a while,
yes, for a limited time. Then these doubts started to creep in as I became less naive, I guess, in the world, and started to experience certain things. Come to terms with my sexuality was another big issue that I had to struggle through. Eventually started to question these things. It was obviously happened over years and years.
Yeah. Was that a painful process?
Yes, it was a painful process. Yes, it was difficult to reconcile old friends and family who were Christians and how to deal with staying friends with them, even though I wasn't considering that there was a God anymore.
Right. Did you ever have a sort of secret atheist time where you were going to church but not really believing?
I don't think to the extent that Mike did. No, I don't think that was. Obviously, I was away at university, and so I could be a fresh person from a new start, and so I didn't have that until I
So this all happened obviously at a time of general transition
yes,
in your life.
Yes,
so
that's
perhaps
right.
that's part of the story.
I think that definitely helped. Yeah.
Yeah, Mike, when you meet people like Ben who have gone through a similar experience to the one you went through, I mean, there's always that temptation to offer them an apologetic argument, isn't there? I mean, what for you is the value of those kinds of objective arguments that initially Ben did try to kind of prop up his faith with?
I think apologetic arguments are incredibly destructive, actually. And that's based on brain science. When you look at someone who has a resilient faith that effectively changes their behavior, that is beneficial to their emotional states, that would be what we would call, you know, a healthy, balanced Christian faith, that network of God in someone's brain is associated with the prefrontal cortex, but not centered there. It's distributed throughout the brain, including the brain's emotional centers. And neuroscientists say that belief in God is more like a feeling or an experience than a set of ideas. And apologetics arguments over-focus our thinking in the prefrontal cortex and actually become destructive in sustaining a belief. And so when I meet someone who's had an experience where they've kind of analyzed their way out of God, what I want to figure out is, are they content? Are they at peace? And if they're at peace, I'm not here to upset their apple cart. I'm not an apologist or an evangelist. I very intentionally target my work toward people who want to believe in God, who are not at peace, but can't because of scientific objections. People who have gone through a deconstruction process and found themselves in a healthy, contented secularism, I'm much more interested in partnering with them for social good and for benefiting the world than I am convincing them to believe what I believe about God.
It's a very, very interesting way of doing things, Mike. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a short moment's time. We're talking to Mike McCarg, known online as Science Mike, about his new book, Finding God in the Waves, how he lost his faith and found it again through science. Our other guest today on the programme, Ben Watts, who is our atheist, and we're going to be continuing the conversation very shortly. Is your tinsel looking tired? Does your nativity need a new lease of life? Then do not fear. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we've 101 fresh ideas for Christmas in your church. Okay, it's about 27 really. But you'll also find amazing stories of near-death experiences, why culture is turning against porn, and how you can make sure your pastor doesn't burn out. All that plus much more. Request a free sample copy of the December magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Mike McCarg is on the show today, and we're talking about how he found God in the waves. The title of his new book is Finding God in the Waves. He became an atheist, lost his faith, found it again through science. It's just such an interesting story. I can highly recommend the book. I spent the last couple of weeks dipping in and out of it, and It's told very well. If you want to find out more about Mike and the book, findinggodinthewaves.com, place to go. In conversation today on the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together, this is with Ben Watts today. Ben, my studio guest, and he was a Christian. He was an evangelical Christian growing up, but became an atheist after studying biology and evolution at university. If you want more about Ben, exchristianskeptic.blogspot.co.uk. Says what it is on the tin pretty much there. So I want to kind of pursue this a little bit further, Ben, and get some of your input on some of the things that the book raised for you. I mean, just going back to what you were saying at the end of that last section there, Mike, show that you're contributing to do today does do a lot of apologetic stuff. We do kind of have people coming on arguing for the resurrection, arguing for God from philosophy and so on, and lots of that stuff. And I can imagine a few people, spluttering on their cups of tea as they listen, as you say, apologetics, is useless. I mean, I can understand that I can understand that the argument that there is a time and a place for apologetics, and that not everyone is actually really looking for an apologetic argument necessarily. And in my experience, very often it's often helpful for Christians who are looking for objective reasons for their faith, as well as the experiential reasons they may have had for their faith. And in a sense, I think there's a journey in your own, in the book yourself, where obviously some things become explicable in ways that atheism can't make sense of. I mean, you spend some time talking about the fact that this realization you had that the experience of love and community and those sorts of things aren't purely explicable by naturalistic means, that it's more than just the electrons and the electrochemical reactions and everything going on in us. That's not a full explanation of what happens when you look at your daughter in the face. So to what extent can we bring those sorts of arguments to bear, when it comes to trying to give people a reason for the faith we have?
Oh, that's a great question. Essentially, you could imagine the role of apologetics done well is very similar to what I guess my book is trying to do. So you've revealed me as a little bit of a hypocrite straight out of the gate.
That's all right.
But you've
I'm
got
one
this
too.
Idea where what you're trying to do is give people enough rational justification to keep people from being rationally obsessed with God. The more your faith is associated with rational defense and rational analysis, neurologically, the more fragile it is. Because a better set of ideas can always kind of enter your brain's computational machinery and win the day. And to have a faith that's lasting, it has to be coupled with a love and a trust of whatever you identify with as God. And that looks radically different on a brain scanner. So I think apologetics is great for someone who has faith and starts to have questions, and to give them a framework to hold on to their practice of faith and their understanding of faith. I think apologetics is good for people who are curious about God and trying to find an entry point into Christian faith and practice. I think apologetics as a singular point of emphasis in faith, or as a primary means of evangelizing or proselytizing, is, scientifically speaking, less effective than other approaches.
I'm very much inclined to agree with you. I mean, my experience, having done this show for over a decade now, is that apologetics, I think, rarely will win someone who doesn't have some kind of inclination towards God at a heart level, in that sense. And you know, it's that old adage that you can't argue someone into the kingdom of God or whatever. But Ben, let's bring you into the conversation at this point. I guess I'm interested to know, could you ever conceive your story turning out like Mike's? Is there ever, you know, what would it take, do you feel, for you to come back? I mean, what Mike's returned to is not certainly exactly what he had before, but nonetheless, he's obviously returned to a belief that there is more than matter and science alone, in that sense. What might it take for you to go on that kind of journey?
It's a difficult question. I think it would take a lot. Firstly, it would take some argument that God exists that I haven't heard already, which would be a big deal because there's a lot that I've heard already. And it would take an argument that's, I think, radically different from one I've heard before that would convince me there is...
It would still be an argument, effectively, though.
I think that's the first stop, yeah. I think it would have to be an argument. I think about why I believe other things. I think about why I believe that the world is round, for example, and I think there's all sorts of evidence that are better than the flat earthers' arguments. Mm. And so I'm convinced that the arguments that the earth is round are correct, and so that's why I believe the earth is round. The same with evolution, for example. You know, there's all sorts of arguments that evolutionists give why evolution is true that I think are correct in having studied them. So I think,
and you would approach God with the same kind of scientific approach.
I think so, yeah. I think that's the way to go.
Has that changed? Because I mean, presumably you didn't start believing God on the basis of a scientific argument.
No, and I think that's the wrong way to do it. I think having been brought up in a Christian home means that I have a predisposition to accept arguments that are for God and reject arguments that are against God. And so that's the way that I see lots of Christians I know boosting their faith in the religion they already believe in. And so you have to obviously enter it with a neutral mind. I know that's difficult to do with everything, but I think there's also things like why... The added argument of why we haven't come across this good argument for God already adds more fuel to the fire, because if there really was a God, it wouldn't be so difficult to find arguments for God. And so
what about Mike's experience that was obviously a turning point, as he described it so eloquently in the book? Do you feel like an experience like that could persuade you in a different direction?
I think this is one of the points that we might disagree on, me and Mike, and I probably need some more clarification on how Mike would describe himself and what where his affiliations are right now, because I don't, to me it's not completely clear if you, Mike, would be an atheist or I think you said in the past, I think you were discussing it with Ryan Bell and on a podcast, and you said you were a mystic, and so I think that's where you would say you were, I assume. I'd like to know.
Well, I mean,
a bit more about what you call yourself.
It's a straight up kind of question, then, Mike. I mean, are you I guess a Christian? B, a theist in that sense, or are you, I don't know, something else altogether now at this point in your journey?
Absolutely a Christian, although some would disagree, and I admit that.
Yeah,
but I don't feel too bad about that, because every Christian would be considered not a Christian by some other Christian somewhere. That's the nature of our faith, and it's, you know, very fractious denominations. I would call myself a mystic for sure, which would say that I believe God can be known through experience, but not contained in language. So we create metaphors that point to God, but we don't encapsulate God with that language. And in the theist-atheist divide, I'll bunt and say I'm neither, that I would probably consider myself a non-theist, because an atheist lacks belief in any god or gods. And a theist not only believes in a personal god, but believes very specific things about God's will, agency, consciousness, and plan for humanity. And I don't presume to know that much about God, that I expect to be regularly surprised in my practice of faith and following God. And I think that's probably pretty Old Testament. I think maybe Colette would agree with me in Ecclesiastes with that approach to God.
So obviously most people think in the category, Mike, of theist, atheist, Christian, non-Christian. And so when you say I'm a non-theist Christian, and that's going to have a few people scratching their heads saying, well, what exactly does that mean? Obviously, for you, there are these specific aspects of what being a theist means that makes it difficult in that sense to express it that way. I mean, if I could go another route, you know, do you believe in a supernatural realm in that sense to life?
I don't know. What would that even mean?
That more exists than the chemistry and physical stuff of the universe.
I guess what I'm saying is we so know little about the physical stuff. Materialism already is full of mystery and surprise that I don't know what more than material would mean or would look like. I'm open to it, but I don't have any grounds to make like a positive fact claim. I certainly experience through mysticism, God is love. I experience through mysticism a Christ which invites all of creation towards reconciliation. And those are things I believe deeply. I just know I can't defend them as fact claims, right? If Ben and I were to debate about my Christology, I would have very little empirical grounds to say, no, here's why you have to believe as I do. It is a very, very, it's a matter of faith and trust that leads me to ideas about God, not, empirical grounding.
Sure. Ben,
doing is admitting the weakness of my position preemptively, while also saying my life is radically transformed by those beliefs.
Hmm. Anything to add on that then, Ben?
Yeah, so, I mean, perhaps it would be better to talk about me as an atheist. I would say I don't believe in God. Mm-hmm. I think there are parts that I get passionate about within life, so science I get passionate about. There are some things that I get maybe emotional about, or I think are perhaps you could use the word spiritual. I wouldn't say that means there's a God behind it all. I think there's all sorts of art or poetry or music that make me feel spiritual, as lots of atheists would find. I then have a struggle to then take another step further and say, therefore, it's possible there's a God. And so I slightly get confused when Mike says, I'm an atheist, but... I guess Mike's saying
a non-theist.
Yeah,
a non-theist.
I definitely don't say I'm an atheist.
No, okay.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, Mike, you're messing with our categories. So I think, and I think in that sense, that's part of what's so interesting in the book is trying to pin you down as to what you are, and obviously you're saying it's not so easy to do that. There's a sense in which your fascination with science, your love of science comes through in every chapter. And in the second half of the book, it's very much about taking the scientific approach to these issues of prayer and Jesus and what happens in the brain and that kind of thing, and the astronomy and so on. I mean, let's talk about prayer, because I think this was a fascinating
If I could say one other thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
The theist-atheist divide.
Mm.
That's a post-Enlightenment way of viewing reality.
Okay.
And it's very, very useful to categorize and be definitive about our cognition and our experiences. There's a fantastic book on neuroscience called The Master and His Emissary, a book which is not religious in origin, that basically denotes that what we've done post-Enlightenment is elevate one particular brain state above the others. And when I practice my faith, I'm very much cultivating a pre-Enlightenment way of viewing the world that's more holistic and less definitive and less based on categorization, which is why it's difficult. I'm not being evasive. If I'm honest about my faith, it is incredibly difficult to slice and dice and put into buckets in a post-Enlightenment manner.
And I think in that sense, yes, when you go back to Jesus and the Jews of his time, they didn't have the same distinction that we have between spirit and body and that kind of thing. It was all very much a unitary thing, wasn't it? And we tend to have become very dualistic in our thinking about a supernatural realm and a physical realm and so on. Is that kind of where you're going with that sort of stuff, Mike?
Absolutely. I would go back to, sure, I believe in a spirit and a body, but I think those things are indivisible. And I think that's a more historically grounded Christian faith than some of what we've done since, especially post-Reformation.
Well, let's talk about prayer, because one of the bits that I just made a note in my copy of your book is here in your chapter on prayer. You say, I still use intercessory prayer. I still pray for people in troubling times, like my dad after his stroke, and I still pray for people in good times that they be blessed and grow. But I no longer do so within the framework of my pre-atheism faith, the framework that casts God as something like an awe-inspiring genie with a divine will who hands down decisions that are inscrutable from our human perspective. These days, my intercessory prayers are an act of surrender, a way to voice my hopes and my hopelessness, my power to act and my powerlessness. When I pray for things I hope for, I'm searching for ways I can act to make a situation better. When I pray in situations I find hopeless, I'm searching for that redemptive perspective. And here research throws a bone to intercessory prayer. Studies have shown that people who pray to God about problems in this way achieve a positive emotional effect, similar to if they'd seen a therapist. Prayer helps us grieve what we've lost, forgive those who've hurt us, and maintain a positive outlook on life. Intercessory prayer is useful and beneficial in helping people surrender to and process their emotions and heal from trauma. And so in that sense, Mike, you are saying there are obviously scientifically provable benefits to prayer. And you've kind of, you no longer really pray in the sense of hoping to move a divine will in one direction or another. It's more about this kind of act of surrender to that divine thing, whatever word you want to give it in that sense. Is that what I'm getting there?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. There's the same tension played out, you know, throughout the discussion, if we could call it that, about God's character as it unfolds through the scriptures, of what prayer does to God. How does God respond? Does God respond? You see different opinions on that. You know, Job would go one way. Different parts of Proverbs may lean another. And where I'm at today is, if I think my prayer moves God's will, and I try to determine why that happens, I immediately raise a ton of philosophical, logical, and ethical quandaries. but if instead I approach prayer as a means of being in God's presence and being transformed by that divine presence, that's a completely different thing entirely, and something that is more compatible with a scientific worldview.
Does Mike's now kind of the faith he now inhabits make sense to you at any level, Ben, as someone who obviously had a faith that perhaps was not dissimilar to Mike's in his pre-atheism stage, if you like? Does the faith Mike now speaks of, which is obviously harder to pin down in absolutes, and where, I mean, is it just okay, good for you, Mike, that works for you?
Yeah, that's a part of it. I think as an atheist myself, I would see reading that section of the book on prayer as it very interesting. I think it's it reminds me of something like meditation, where you're feeling peaceful and spiritual and attached to the universe, and you know, etc., etc. I don't see why we have to then say there's a God behind that, and, okay. and I don't see why. I mean, there aren't any reasons, as far as I can tell, why we would think that goes any further than that.
In that sense, for you, the ultimate explanation for anything like that is it's in your head.
Yeah.
It's what you're doing mentally.
Sure.
That's helping you into
and there's nothing
state.
Wrong with that. I wouldn't say that's anything the problem with that.
Right.
And I could quite happily do that myself if I, you know, fancied doing some meditation, but I don't see that means as a God, or we have to go any further with our language on that issue at all.
And I'm not even sure you're saying, Mike, that this in any way proves God either, are you?
No, what I'm saying is the practice of prayer will help people feel close to God if that's something they desire. And here's a really important point. When people say God, they almost always mean something different than another person who says the word God.
Sure.
That there's an incredible diversity about who God is, what God is. And I think that's one of the more flawed assumptions of atheism, is to assume there's a single definition for God. And I think something like igtheism might do a better job of saying, before we can even have this discussion, we have to nail down what we mean by the word God. Because a pantheist who believes the universe is God believes in a God that is absolutely provable if you accept that the universe works or exists.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you find yourself, Ben, that if you were to approach faith again from any angle, can you imagine going back to your former type of faith? You could imagine that, or would it have to be something that looks different in the way that Mike's obviously looks different today to what
I think so, yeah. I think if I hypothetically were to go back to faith, it would be very different. It wouldn't be as fundamentalist. It would be more mystical, as you know, something lots of my friends and family are considering changing their views and having also questions and doubts about the faith that they've been in recently. And so a faith that would be more nuanced and more intricate and interesting, I think, would be a faith that would be more attractive to lots of people.
Sure. Again, I guess, you know, and Mike said from the outset, he's not here to try and persuade you if you're happy with where you are. You know, he's very much not taking on the role of an evangelist in this context. But, I mean, for Mike, obviously, there was a sense in which he felt something missing. Mm. And that was answered again by this experience and the way he put it all together in his life again. For you, do you feel like actually no, there's nothing to be kind of filled in? There's no gap here. I'm a perfectly happy, balanced person without.
Yeah,
that.
I think I am, and I think if I did feel like there's something fundamental missing from my life in regards to faith, I would possibly, you know, find it elsewhere. I found that sort of social side of religion in other things, like being in the skeptic societies and things like that. I think if I I still question, if I felt like that, why do I need anything behind it?
Sure.
And so because I would feel slightly less sociable or feel like there's something missing, I wouldn't then think, oh, that means there must be a God, you know. It doesn't follow one from the other.
Yeah. I'm sorry to come back to this again, is there any kind of, could you envisage an experience that would make you think, yes, maybe there is a God after all? Or I don't know, because I do hear from some atheists, even if I had something like the experience Mike had, I still wouldn't be able to attribute that to God.
No.
It would still be something happening in my head. It would still
absolutely.
Be
that's the big
explainable, yeah. Physiologically.
That's the big questions I had when I was reading Mike's story and when he was talking about standing on the beach and the waves washing over him and hearing God, audibly hearing God. And my questions were, why are you not being more sceptical about that, or sceptical about that? Why does that mean that there is a God? For me, I'd attribute that to my brain and psychology and different experiences that was going on.
Sure. We'll come back to Mike to get an answer to that in a moment's time. We're just coming towards the end of our second part, believe it or not, of Unbelievable today. Talking to Mike McCarg, and Ben Watts on the programme today. Mike's book, Finding God in the Waves, How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science, published here in the UK by Hodder and Stoughton. And I'll make sure there are links to Mike's website and, of course, to Ben Watts' website as well, who's our atheist guest, having a conversation with Mike about the book today. Be interested to hear what you have to say as well. Again, if you want to email in, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be hearing some of your thoughts about recent shows towards the end of today's programme. And of course, you can find us online via Twitter, Facebook and all the other means from the website of today's programme. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do join us again as we conclude our conversation.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week for dialogue and debate. And Mike and Ben are going to be continuing and concluding their conversation in just a moment's time. Again, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on the programme, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We've also, of course, got the Facebook and Twitter accounts to do that. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb to see what I'm posting up on a regular basis at the Facebook page. And at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter. There's also, of course, the Unbelievable Facebook group, and that's very much dedicated to Christians and non-Christians debating things. It can get pretty, you know, hairy in there, so whether you want to go there and get involved very much depends on whether you enjoy online debates and that kind of thing. It is a closed group. You have to ask to join the group, but I regularly let in swathes of new people to the Unbelievable discussion group on Facebook. This from Dan, who's one of the frequenters there, says, not sure how much you lurk in the group yourself, but I took a casual poll. Thought you might be interested in seeing the results of where people are from in the group. And here's the breakdown. Most people from the USA. I'm not surprised by that at all. Dan, I know most of my correspondence on a weekly basis tends to come from the USA. Australia and New Zealand was next, interestingly, above England. So England actually came in third in terms of those who responded to this little online poll in the Unbelievable group. Then Canada, Australia, other UK countries, so I guess that's Northern Ireland and Wales and Scotland. People's Republic of California, says one person. Obviously doesn't think of themselves as part of the USA, and then other countries as well. Well, wherever you're listening from, you're very welcome today to the programme. I hope you're enjoying it, whether you interact via the Facebook pages or not. Be lovely to hear from you, though, and we will be hearing some of your feedback a little later on in the programme. One of the things I'll be bringing up is a blog that I mentioned recently on the Facebook page of Unbelievable. Had quite the response from atheist contributors, and I'll be telling you what they had to say a little later on. More on that in a short moment's time. Right now, time to finish up this week's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We're concluding our discussion on Finding God in the Waves today. It's the new book from Mike McCarg. He is known online as Science Mike, host of a couple of podcasts, Our Science Mike and The Liturgist with Michael Gunga. His new book, Finding God in the Waves, tells his journey, having been a Southern Baptist all his life, of losing his faith and becoming a secret atheist, all the while pretending to be a Christian at church. He's a self-confessed science nerd, and he came to see the world in purely atheistic scientific terms until an experience on a beach, and partially involving the sometimes controversial pastor Rob Bell, actually changed his mind. And it's just the most fascinating journey through science, faith, and his own particular walk. If you're looking for some Christmas reading, can highly recommend it. And we've had in studio Ben Watts interacting with Mike today. Ben is a science researcher in Cambridge who had a faith of his own growing up, lost it after studying evolution at university. Coming back to you, Mike, just in that last section, we talked a little bit again about this experience you had on the beach, the waves that came up, this audible voice, as it seemed, that you heard, and this sort of transcendent experience that followed. Very hard to put into words. But for Ben, his point is, Mike, why would that make you believe in God again? Because all it would make me see is that I had a really interesting experience in my brain. And Mike, you, as much as anyone knows, you know, the workings of the brain. So why do you go from an experience happening in my brain to something more than that?
Well, I think this is maybe the most critical point of the whole book. Is not simply that I had an experience and then said, does God exist? And then answered, oh, yes, because I just met God. My experience on the beach compelled me to ask the question, if God exists, who or what is God? So it was as much less of a true false statement of some particular understanding of God, but it was more of a search for the origin for that experience. And then if I could kind of understand where that experience came from, suddenly I understand all my friends and family who are people of faith much better, because I'm hopefully going to understand when they're talking about God, what do they mean, right? And that's why I spend so much, like the second half of the book, unpacking, like, what do we mean by the word God? And with all these different theological claims and assumptions about who or what God is, which are more or less empirically verifiable. So in the book, I put forth what I kind of call an empirically defensible idea about God in the form of a philosophical axiom, not a logical axiom. And I say something like, God is at least the set of forces that created and sustained the universe as experienced via a psychosocial model rooted in human brains, which is not an orthodox Christian God at all. That's effectively pantheism, and that God is the universe reflecting on itself in the human brain, which is not just unorthodox, it's like full-on heresy, right? But that was enough for me to say, okay, well, when I use the word God, I'm talking about a particular posture that humans take in viewing the world, which is not ridiculous, which is not poppycock. It's nothing I have to like feel embarrassed inside of myself when I pursue that God. What I found was, in the pursuit, now that I felt justified in some basic forms of Christian faith and practice, I evolved a more orthodox, some more traditional ideas about God, just with the admission that these aren't empirical fact claims, that it is entirely possible that all I'm doing is putting fancy window dressing on a fantasy. But when you experience God, it's so compelling, it's so persuasive, it's so powerful that I don't mind holding those beliefs in an open hand. Now, I won't try to bully other people to accept them. I won't rigorously defend them, but I will allow myself to be transformed by them. And, you know, I think that, you know, you could kind of call my axiom the faith of a mustard seed, right? It's this very, very small step towards God and that grows and blooms into something else entirely.
And you list a number of these axioms about Christian faith sort of as an appendix to the book, really. And they are interesting that, as you say, each one is prayer is at least a form of meditation that encourages the development of healthy brain tissue that reduces stress and that can connect us to God. There's a sense in which you're giving a sort of an at least justification about what this is at, you know, if you stripped away all the normal stuff you might associate with it in a religious framework. But obviously you feel you're able to build from that platform into something that is, as you say, has come to resemble something more like an orthodox Christian faith.
And if I could abuse the analogy a little bit.
Go ahead.
You know, there's this thing called string theory, which is an attempt to describe with more accuracy what gravity is, because we don't have a definitive understanding at all of what gravity is in physics. And so we would kind of say that that gravity is at least, and then we would kind of talk about general relativity and then admit that relativity fails to explain quantum effects. And that's what we can prove. But we're also working on a hypothesis called string theory that doesn't have evidence to support it yet, but is helps us solve problems, helps us make sense of the world. And we just admit that this isn't a capital T theory that should be accepted, but instead a working hypothesis. My axiom would be like relativity, and theologically speaking, this is something I feel very comfortable with. And the further I go on, theology is much more akin to string theory. It's a working hypothesis that helps me see the world more effectively, but nothing I can say everyone else should accept.
That's a really interesting analogy, actually. That helps me to see where you're coming from in many ways, Mike. Ben, so that was the long answer to your question about what's going on. Why not just accept this is something happening in your brain, Mike? What's your kind of response? And we're going to have to start to draw things to a close at this point.
Well, I think it's all great, I think, but. As with lots of things, we have to be careful with definitions. And so if you're saying something and calling it something else, we're going to get confused.
Sure.
And so lots of parts of the axioms you were just talking about, I would agree with lots of what Mike has written about them. And I'd say I agree with the set of natural forces that sustain the universe and created the universe. As if I talked to physicists, that's exactly what they would say. But
you wouldn't call it God.
I wouldn't call it God, and neither would they. And so... It sounds slightly disingenuous or misleading to say I'm going to define God as the physics of the universe, or I'm going to define prayer as meditation, when you can... It's like Occam's razor, where you take the simplest explanation as the best one, and why bother piling other definitions or other baggage that doesn't need to be there when you can just have it as the most reduced one. And so that's my question.
Yeah.
Why bother?
Mike, do you want to take a quick crack at that?
Yeah, that's an incredibly enlightenment way of viewing the world. And it's perfectly valid. It just forecloses you away from some experiences and some parts of the human experience. And I want to be more open to the fullness of what my brain has to offer me experientially. And so I approach faith very much like art. And in terms of like disingenuous, I actually respect that critique a lot. And I would say that's why I'm intentionally trying to put forth very specific definitions, is because I think most discussions of faith and doubt end up being accidentally disingenuous because they don't open themselves to the elephant in the room. And that some of the ideas people hold most dear are the poorest defined, and we lack a common framework for discussion when we use words. Look no further than the great debate over whether Christians and Muslims serve the same, quote, God, unquote. That reveals an incredible diversity of ideas about what a single word means. Just go look up God in the dictionary. There's like 35 definitions. So I'm trying to be specific about what I'm saying so people aren't misled by my life, my work, or what I say.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you,
on the program today. It's been really, really interesting. And who knows what interesting experiences you may one day write a book about.
But
it's been great, though.
Is
this the kind of book you could, you know, you obviously found it very interesting having shared a similar experience to Mike in the past. Is it the kind of thing you could give to a Christian or a non-Christian and say, you'll find this interesting too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the first half of the book I really identified with. I thought it was brilliant. Just very similar to what I experienced. I think if I had a Christian friend or someone who was very fundamentalist in what they believed, I could give them this and say, read what Mike's talking about religion, and hopefully that would soften their views on certain things. I think it was that. In that respect, it was fantastic. So, Yeah, I recommend it to lots of people. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's lovely to have a very friendly atheist and a very friendly non-theist Christian on the program today. I don't think I've ever had one of those, Mike, but it's been fun to have you on. Thank you very much for being involved with the show today. I know you're hugely busy running around promoting the book, speaking at events and so on, but I really hope it gets in the hands of many people who'll find it very helpful as well. So all the very best, and thank you for joining me on the show today, Mike.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ben, thanks for being with me too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. And if you want to get in touch yourself, do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, as ever, the Facebook and Twitter accounts are there as well if you want to get involved. All of the links available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can probably tell I've developed a little bit of a cold in the run-up to Christmas. So at least you can't catch it by listening to the podcast or the radio station. You can, of course, look forward to a special Christmas edition of Unbelievable coming up on Christmas Eve, Saturday the 24th of December. I'm going to be hosting a discussion on the Star of Bethlehem. Was it just a theological invention, or is there actually scientific evidence for the Star of Bethlehem? Well, three different perspectives are going to be joining me on that programme to debate that subject. So looking forward to that. And towards the end of today's programme, I'll tell you what's coming up next week, which is, of course, just a week out from Christmas as well. John Rook on Facebook got in touch to say, I'm a recent listener to your show. Love the quality of the content. One of the most amazing things that this show teaches, apart from the content that the speakers present, is that of an object lesson in civil discourse. This might be the most valuable lesson for us as a culture at large, namely how to engage each other with respect and dignity. I'm proud it's being modelled by a Christian. I do wish, mind you, I haven't scoured the archives, is that the views of Christian triperspectivalism of John Frame could be discussed. His views of basic epistemology have revolutionized my ability to think and discuss with others of different viewpoints. He basically holds that each fact can be described from three perspectives: a normative, the philosophical principles, the situational, the specific empirical data, and the existential, the subjective human element of interacting. He goes on to say that each perspective is inseparable from the others, yet most intellectual disagreements occur usually when there is a singling out of one perspective while disregarding the others. Most of the time I hear people argue past each other when their disagreements lie in some basic tenets which they aren't discussing at all. It seems that each perspective presents an avenue of true knowledge and affect how someone interacts with a fact or truth or principle. Anyway, it sounds fascinating to me, and I've heard of it before, John, but never really had it on the show. So thank you for getting in touch. That was John, who got in touch via Facebook, actually, to leave me that message. Now, just before we go to some of your responses to the Doug Axe and Keith Fox debate of a couple of weeks ago, when Doug Axe came in to talk about his new book, Undeniable, why our intuition that life is designed is confirmed by biology, that was under debate. We'll just mention that I put up a blog in the last week or two by Chris Goswami. He's a blogger for us at Premier Christianity magazine, and Faith Explored is brought to you in association with that mag. I'm the editor of the magazine. Anyway, this particular blog was titled Why I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist, and it was Chris basically making the point that he believes that atheists are bound to a kind of metaphysical point of view, a creed, if you like, about the reality of purpose, existence, the universe, and so on. And he kind of spelled this out in a number of things that he believes atheists are required to believe to be thoroughgoing atheists. Well, I put that up and said I've never really been convinced by the whole, you know, I just lack belief as an atheist in God, a thing that I do believe that for a thoroughgoing atheism there is a kind of a metaphysical number of metaphysical beliefs that you have to subscribe to. That generated all kinds of interesting responses. Lots of people calling me out and saying, straw man, Justin, and I can't believe after, you know, all these years of hosting Unbelievable and talking to atheists, you'd still think like that, and so on. And I engage with some of it on the blog. If you want to see it for yourself, go to the Facebook page of Unbelievable, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. I never actually did not mean any disrespect to any atheists, but I mean, sometimes I do get the feeling that some atheists think that you know, having hosted this show for so many years, I've practically become an atheist. Not true. I do actually still take the view that actually atheism does, you know, when it, you know, you take it to its logical conclusion is in terms of the naturalistic aspect of atheism, that it does entail a number of consequences, you know, about the purpose of the universe, i.e. there is no purpose of the universe. That's a belief that I think an atheist should hold if they do believe that there's nothing supernatural going on, nothing beyond matter in motion in the universe. I've never really heard a compelling explanation that would not sort of lead to that particular conclusion. And a number of others that I think Chris Goswami spelled out quite well in his blog. Nonetheless, there were a number of people who wanted to respond. I'm going to be putting up another response to that blog from former show guest Corey Markham, who's an atheist, who thinks that he would like to respond. So look out for that. If you were incensed by me putting that up on the Unbelievable Facebook feed, you will see Corey's response in due course. But let's move to some of these responses to that debate between Keith Fox and Doug Axe. Fabian says, I'm listening to the programme. What a very interesting book that Doug has obviously written. You may want to consider inviting Cambridge scientist Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, who's published the book The Science Delusion. The BBC had wanted to bring him face-to-face with Dawkins in a programme, but Dawkins refused. Sheldrake is a member of the Church of England and an Anglican. Thank you very much, Fabian. Darren says, I know Christians like to think they're being persecuted. However, your guest didn't stop getting published because he was challenging the consensus. You're talking about Doug here, Darren. In science, that's how you become famous. He ran into problems because he started proposing a magical being exists and is creating biological processes without any argument other than he couldn't figure out how it could happen naturally. That isn't science. That's just making beep up. Says Darren. So we know where you stand on the debate, Darren. Steve says, perhaps papers like this effectively disprove Axe's thesis, and you link me to a scientific article. And Steve, in the rest of your email, you say, Doug wants us to believe that new proteins can't evolve because the chances of this are too tiny, but we have direct evidence of new proteins arising in some populations of fruit flies from bits of DNA that were once non-coding. These strings of random DNA can be found in other wind insects, but it's only in certain species of fruit fly where certain mutations have happened that have allowed them to start being transcribed and translated. These genes are called de novo genes because they don't seem to have ancestors. They've effectively risen from the ashes that exist due to previous mutations, duplications, infections, and rearrangements. These proteins, these de novo genes form, are not entirely well folded, whereas Doug Axe's premise is that a protein has to be precisely folded to have any function at all. These proteins tend to be short. They tend to be polymorphic. These proteins are also not well tuned. That when some of these genes are knocked out, the fly often dies. It shows us that even though these proteins are new, they've arisen recently, they aren't well folded and aren't fine-tuned. They're still critical to the survival of the fly. Thank you, Steve. A scientific response there to Doug's position. This from Richard says, another fascinating discussion, but I did feel they were slightly talking past each other. Doug said that the chances of a complex functioning protein occurring by chance was infinitesimally small, but he was perfectly okay with inefficient proteins becoming more efficient by evolution. As we have good evidence that some evolution does occur, but that it fails completely to explain everything, surely that's one possible answer, that the proteins in this case were originally made or designed as starting blocks, but then evolved. Thank you, Richard. This from David says, I can never understand why theistic evolutionists like Keith Fox are saying with their God upholding the universe and God guiding the evolutionary process stuff, unless it's just that God set the whole thing up and let it run according to natural processes, but God knew how it would turn out. In other words, it's 17th century deism. There seems to be no practical difference between their view and Darwinism. That is the view that, one, life arose from inanimate material by random events, and two, consciousness and intelligence arose by random mutation plus natural selection acting on some basic form of life. In other words, theistic evolution has zero explanatory power. Tim in Penny Farms, Florida, says, two great shows in a row on my favourite subject. I'm open to both views as being able to explain what really happened in the history of life on Earth. But I end up coming down on the side of Doug Axe. Sure, God could have used a totally gradualistic process to create with, even one that looks Darwinian if he chose to simply guide things on the quantum level so that it looks to us to be chance worked on by blind natural selection. While that could work in theory, if God did things that way, there should be evidence of that gradualism-only scenario in the fossil record. That, however, is precisely what we do not see. We only see sudden appearance with long periods of stasis, while we should see a general pattern of uninterrupted gradual change over time. The few examples Darwinists point to of transition fossils are debatable and do little, if anything, to counter the overwhelming evidence for massive change over geologically short time spans that characterise the history of life. Appealing to the incompleteness of the fossil record is a naturalism of the gaps argument that loses loses credibility with each new fossil find. The question is not what God could have done or should have done, but what God actually did do, if anything. Since we cannot observe that directly, we can only evaluate the evidence left behind and reach our conclusion based on an inference to the best explanation. That includes both the record of nature, which clearly points to non-gradualistic processes being involved, and experiments into what Darwinistic mechanisms are capable of doing. Those have categorically shown that unguided processes have no power to produce the kind of highly coordinated and integrated information that new life forms require. Keith Fox seems to believe that the natural laws that God created to control the natural order are sufficient to explain the origin of such information, but laws and chance processes simply cannot produce new information. Thank you very much. And Kevin, whose email I read on the last program, said, thanks for reading it. Since you asked, I wonder what he thinks about the Doug Axe and Keith Fox show. I'll answer. Doug Axe did a fine job laying out the possibilities of what Darwinian random mutation can and can't accomplish. He also made a good point that science can prove things impossible. Fox said, never say never. But I think we can say never. As Doug pointed out, a cheetah will never run at twice the speed of light. However, I suspect the cheetah analogy isn't a good one when considering cells and for biochemical processes. We know a lot more about the physics of motion and a cheetah's muscle output than we do about the interconnections of proteins in a cell. I'm not an expert in mutagenesis or the enzyme work Axe and others have done, so the question I'd have for Doug is, how complicated are the systems in which these experiments are being done? We know that there are all sorts of guiding proteins, chaperone proteins and scaffolding proteins that I would think could play a big role in selecting for or against a mutation. I can believe that if you start with something partially designed and use random processes to get something better, it won't work if it's done in a simple virus or an in vitro test tube system. But what would happen in a complex system like a eukaryotic cell? I'm sure there are experiments which have addressed this. I'm just not familiar with them. Thank you very much, Kevin. You finish your email. Sorry, I couldn't read all of it, by the way. Saying, Unbelievable is my definitive Monday podcast, the first and best one of the week. Very kind. Thank you very much. So many more emails, actually, on Doug Axe and Keith Fox, but I'm going to have to leave them for the moment. We're out of time on today's show, which is sad, but all good things must come to an end. And I hope my voice will be a bit better for next week's programme as well. In any case, thank you for being with me on Unbelievable this week, and just time to tell you what's coming up at the same time next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, we're doing something completely different on next week's programme, talking about Hitler. And without invoking Godwin's law, we're aiming to ask the question, was Hitler anti-Christian? Lots have been said and written about this over the years. In fact, just last year, Whoopi Goldberg, was it, who claimed that Hitler was a Christian on a TV programme. Richard Weikart has been writing a book on this very subject, and you'll hear him talking about why he believes Hitler was certainly no Christian, and why, in many ways, his regime, while purporting to have sort of some Christian aspects, was certainly anti-Christian at its core. Opposite him is going to be another Richard Carrier, who's well known as a Jesus mythicist, but he's going to be talking about his research into Hitler and things that Christians often say show that Hitler was an atheist. He says not so much, actually. Their discussion, was Hitler anti-Christian? Same time next week. Hope you can join me for that here on the show that aims to get you thinking. In the meantime, have a great week, and we'll see you then.